Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
Right now, I am so excited to welcome Stacey Haynes and her discussion on personal and social transformation. How can these serve one another? Stacey is the Director of Methodology at the Strozzi Institute. She's the co-founder of Generative Somatics, bringing embodied leadership and trauma healing in the fields of social justice and climate movements. She's also the author of the recently published The Politics of Trauma, Somatics, Healing, and Social Justice, as well as Healing Sex, a Mind-Body Approach to Healing Sexual Trauma. Stacey, it's really a privilege and a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you. All right, I want to go ahead and dive in. Just so folks know who are watching and listening, I'm going to talk for a bit, then there'll be some time for Q&A, I'm going to talk a little bit more, and then we'll weave a practice in before we close the session today. So the first thing I want to talk about, you know, somatics is such a burgeoning and growing field. And people tend to define it a little bit differently. So I'm just going to let you know what my and what our definition is. So somatics is really, in some ways, a change of paradigm and how we understand ourselves as human beings, and also how we understand how we change. And somatics is really saying that our thinking self, our biology, our evolutionary biology, our emotional self, how we act and how we relate, that is one integrated whole. That's one integrated system. So somatics isn't really kind of like the body add-on to learning or to leadership or to psychotherapy. Rather, it's really a shift in how we understand, again, ourselves as human beings and how we change. So as we go on today, I'll be talking about embodied transformation. What does it mean for an individual to transform in an embodied way? What does it mean for a group, a team, a collective to transform? And of course, in this much broader question about social and economic change, how does it serve, right? How does it serve social change? So, you know, really my definition of transformation, because it's another word that's used a lot, and really the somatic definition, or my somatic definition of transformation, is that we know when we've transformed, when we can take new actions aligned with our vision and our values, even under the same old pressure. Okay, so that's no small thing. It means really being able to shift from reactivity, which has a historical intelligence to it, to action, conversations, ways of building relationship and making contact that's aligned with our vision and our values. And again, that's not just for ourselves, but it's our vision and our values for our families, for our community, and really for our world. So that's a big game of where we're going with embodied transformation. I wanted to just start out by sharing a visual that helps to understand the different components of embodied transformation, and then starts to bring in, again, this connection to kind of the broader scope, kind of the social and the economic and the cultural waters that we swim in. So I'm just gonna share my screen here momentarily. And this is an image, that's probably as good as I can get. You're gonna see a little bit of my mountains in the background there. This is an image of one way of understanding the components of somatic change. Okay. So the first one to really attend to is somatic awareness. How can we feel ourselves at the level of sensation in a way that we're listening to the information that's coming through sensations, through aliveness, through patterns that are actually caught in the psychobiology or in the body? But bringing our awareness there is like reintroducing ourselves to a core language. We really hold that sensations are first. Sensations are underneath emotions. And then we also have stories, right? Some of which are really grounded and some of which are caught in history. But this basic somatic awareness is key to transformation, and whether it's an individual or a collective that's engaging in that. Somatic practice is a second component of the work. And what we mean practice is from kind of our point of view, or my point of view in somatics, every somatic practice has a purpose inside of it. There's kind of a phrase that we use. It goes, we are always practicing something, right? We can't not practice. It's just part of how our psychobiology is built. Is what we're practicing aligned with what we most care about? Yeah. And so when we look at trauma, when we look at social oppression, even when we look at privilege, we have inherited practices that don't actually align with our vision and our values. We have survival strategies that maybe we've learned through difficult experiences or traumatic experiences. Those have us embody certain practices that don't necessarily serve the life that we want to live now or the contribution that we want to make. So when we look at somatic practices, we do standing practices, we do sitting practices, but we look at that there's a purpose inside the practice. So one example is most people who have experienced trauma, whether it was young or more recent, one of the things that trauma can really do is break our sense of safety and really affect our ability to have what I might call centered, responsive boundaries, or even be connected to our needs and make requests, right? And navigate our world based on what we need. So when we're looking at practices, we have practices that are about being able to feel ourselves, center ourselves, and make boundaries that dignify ourselves and dignify others. We have practices that are about centered accountability. So we don't default to over accountability or under accountability. We have practices that are about relearning how to give and receive love. We hold all of these as embodied practices that we really want to build into our muscle memory or rebuild those skills if they were impacted by either trauma or oppression. And then the last piece is this third circle of somatic opening. And that is really working where patterns, whether they're patterns that we've learned through kind of inheritances outside of us, whether it's from family or community or society, or it's patterns that we've learned by trying to survive difficult situations or trauma, that those get locked into the tissues, the fascia, the musculature, and our belief systems. And somatics understands that all of those are connected. So somatic opening is really where we uproot those patterns from the body. It's like we let the body tell its story and then process through some of the pain or energy or confusion that's caught inside of that survival strategy or from that experience. So the last two circles, and this all sets kind of the context for our talk today or our time together, is all of those pieces of somatic transformation are always operating inside of social conditions and economic conditions. So we can't not be a part of the broader social, cultural, and economic conditions in which we live and in which we were raised. And human beings are so adaptive. We're very fast learners. We're learners, as we know, throughout our whole lifetimes. But a lot of what we learn comes from kind of the ineffable of the rules that are happening in our environment. And I think this is one of the pieces that many transformative approaches, and I think particularly in the West, have kind of left out, almost like there can be an individual separate from the social conditions. And because of that, we're missing a whole bunch of the picture, especially when it comes to bridging personal and social transformation. So just wanted to give you this image so we can dive in together today. I'm gonna stop sharing the screen so I can just come back to being with you all. One more thing I wanna say before I pause for Q&A, but you know, I've been in the field of somatics 27 years now. And one of the things that just captured me and has kept me here is that somatics is very, very, it's a very depthful practice. It's a very depthful methodology. It can really touch things and help transform things that are almost inaccessible through our thinking mind, but so deeply important. And on the other side, it's deeply pragmatic. Like, we can concretely learn new skills, learn new ways of being, learn how to expand, to tolerate more joy, to tolerate more complexity, to be skillful inside of contradictions. Those are all learned practices. So kind of the depth and the pragmatism has captured my attention for a very long time. But one of the other things that somatics helps us understand, particularly about trauma, and I'm going to talk about both about individual trauma and also systemic trauma, is that we as human beings have three constitutive or inherent needs. And these really come along with our evolutionary biology. They're just really part of being humans. One is the need for safety. We are really built and wired to track for safety and to adapt to try to create more safety for ourselves and for the people that we identify with. The second thing is that we are a social animal. Belonging is an inherent need. And that means being able to love and receive love and to be part of a community, a pack, a tribe, however you want to think about it. But belonging is very deep. Isolation is very bad for us. We're not built for that. And then the third inherent need is dignity. And that's really having inherent worth and also being dignified or seen as worthy and contributing, right, to the people that we're a part of. So safety, belonging, and dignity, we really see that we have these automatic adaptations if any of those get threatened or challenged. And sadly, inside of trauma, whether it's individual or systemic, those needs are actually broken apart from each other and often left to compete with one another. Like, I can't belong and be safe, so I'm gonna focus on safety and my survival strategies and then become more and more isolated or more and more distrustful. Or often we'll see also with trauma, it's like belonging gets prioritized and we'll actually sacrifice our dignity and belong with people who don't actually respect or care for us because belonging's so important. But part really of how somatics understands trauma or PTSD is that safety and belonging and dignity aren't organized in consort with each other, aren't harmonizing with each other, which is what we really need to heal and to thrive. I'm going to pause there for a minute. I have many other things to say, but Leela, I just wanted to head over to you. Are there any questions before I keep going?
We don't have any in the Q&A. I do want to invite anyone to put them in. And if any of the panelists have a question at any point, if you raise your hand, if you like, give me a sign, I'll make a mental note of that and I can give Stacey a sign. But say, I think I keep going because I think you have us all right on the line, so.
Awesome, okay, good. And really feel free to put your questions in, everyone. So I wanna talk about systemic trauma and then we'll really get to, you know, how can personal transformation and social transformation serve each other? So a way to understand systemic trauma is it is something happening in the social, economic, and cultural sphere that negatively targets or negatively impacts groups of people, okay? And it impacts that group's sense of safety and actual safety, that group's belonging and that group's dignity. So in the United States right now, and it's also global, there is a very kind of next wave of civil rights, next wave of uprising around racial justice. And it is this call around Black Lives Matter. And if we really, from a somatic and trauma understanding, look at it, Black Lives Matter is exactly calling for safety, belonging, and dignity for Black people, right? At a systemic level. So when we look at everything that's been happening with police violence and police killings in the United States, that is a massive threat of safety, right, to the Black community, and has this whole history of slavery in the United States. If we look at belonging, right, any oppressed group is not granted full belonging in their society, right? So we can look along the lines of gender, we can look along the lines of race, we can look along the lines of sexuality, right, a class. So any group that is not as good as, right, the dominant group is literally at the effect of systemic trauma. Now people are going to be impacted in different ways depending on what their resilience factors are and depending on really how piled up those experiences of not safety, not belonging, and not being dignified are. But to me, it's so powerful. Black Lives Matter speaks to getting full safety, belonging, and dignity inside of the systemic context, okay? So when we look at systemic trauma, one of the reasons it's so important for healers or teachers or somaticists to have what we would call a social analysis, or to understand the rules by which society and the economy are organized, is because folks will come to your courses, folks will come to your treatment room, folks will end up on your bodywork table who are struggling with internalized homophobia. But if we don't see that as a trauma, you might not be able to help them, right? Or this is happening. I mean, I think in a lot of embodiment contexts, they are being becoming more racially diverse. And we always have to ask the question, why weren't they racially diverse from the beginning, right? Because the rules by which they were built were mimicking the mainstream rules of basically who's gonna get trained and have the resources to train in these methodologies, okay? So for us as somaticists to go, okay, I have this offer, these skills and competencies and how to work somatically with people. And then we need to really also build a social analysis by which to understand systemic oppression as well, or systemic trauma. We see the things that are shaping us and also shaping the people that we're working with, okay? All right. Any questions, or should I keep rolling? Okay, onward. All right, I'm gonna talk a little bit about why it's so powerful, really, to connect social change and individual change, even though the means to those changes are distinct. They're distinct but interdependent. So I'm just gonna tell a couple of stories from generative somatics. So we're a multiracial somatic organization that brings embodied leadership and trauma healing to people who are engaged in social justice and climate justice movements, okay? So part of kind of the strategy of bringing somatics here is to help support change in the change makers, right? It's like these are already people who've committed their lives really to all of us and all of our well-being. So how do we back them up, support them, and really support their own change and transformation? So there's an organization that we worked with called the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And folks may or may not know this history. And again, sorry, I'm just speaking from a US context, but in the United States, most people in this country got labor rights in the 1940s, which is 80 years ago now. But to get the southern states in the US to sign on to labor rights, domestic workers and farm field workers, which were of course historically the work done by enslaved people, they were left out of the laws. So it's 2020 and most folks know the farm workers movement, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta. They were working for farm workers to get labor rights. And the National Domestic Workers Alliance is working for all domestic workers, nannies, house cleaners, home health care workers, to have basic labor rights, right? Like health insurance and minimum wage and paid vacation, right? All that good stuff. So we designed their leadership development training with them. And we're primarily working with domestic workers. So the vast majority of these women are women of color. Many of them are immigrants to this country, some documented, some not documented. And they're primarily working in isolated contexts in people's homes, right? Which is also a vulnerable position to be in. So as we're working around safety, belonging, and dignity, and we're unpacking, like, what are people's survival strategies? Is it more of an appease response or a fight response or a freeze response, right? Those inherent responses that come with the package of being human. Yeah, fight, flight, freeze, appease, dissociate. None of us have to learn those responses to trauma or threat. They come with the package, right? But when they are kicked off often enough, they become habituated and embodied, right? So under a challenge or a threat, we can't not do them, right? Because they become generalized in the nervous system and the psychobiology. So we're exploring with these domestic worker leaders, under pressure, what happens to you all as a group, right? Because they're a collective of people organizing for social change. And what we found, which is understandable, is the vast majority of these primarily women, under pressure or threat, appeased, right? We all know this move, we all have it. It's like make nice, get smaller, apologize. When you think about all of the social pressure and the social training, to any person who is in a service role, you really understand that as a strategy, as a survival strategy, appease would be a good strategy in that context. Yeah. Now, of course, it wasn't 100%, but that was generally out of these 80 women where the group went under pressure. We don't want to have conflict with each other. We don't want to confront things. If the pressure gets too high, right, we're going to shrink. Now, given their vision, they have this amazing vision for all people having rights, this amazing vision for the care economy, right? Like, I love one of their taglines, is that domestic work is the work that lets all other work happen, right? So we really had to work. What were all the things in their lives that taught them to appease? What was the wisdom inside of that, right? It's a process inside of somatics called blending. We blend with the wisdom of that historical strategy, that safety strategy. But then what do we want to do and practice instead? Because of course, these women are sitting down and meeting with senators and folks in Congress and passing at this point, 17 states have passed a domestic worker bill of rights. State by state by state, it's happening. It's amazing. But appease wasn't the strategy to get there. Yeah. So in both healing that appease response and then practicing in a centered power, right? An ability to stay in their dignity and stay open and connected, even under pressure, even under threat, right? Building in new, basically somatic choices. Yeah. So to me, area of the beautiful connection between by supporting the transformation of the change makers then have an impact, right? That is a contribution to all of us or is much wider than just the individual change for each of them, which is also very, very important. Okay. All right. I'm going to pause again. Leela, do you have any questions or do you want to pull any questions up?
Heidi has a question. She's curious why you choose the phrase appease versus fawn.
Versus fawn?
Yes, F-A-W-N.
That's so interesting. I haven't really heard people use the word fawn, fawning on someone. So why we use appease, maybe it's because it rhymes, fight, flight, freeze, appease, dissociate. Maybe that's it. No, but appease is really a holistic response in the animal world. You'll see it across mammals. You can all try it on with me if you want, but under threat, it's making ourselves less threatening. Yeah. So if we look at dogs, it's when dogs roll over onto their backs and they show their organs, right? Basically what the dog is saying is, I'm not going to hurt you. Don't hurt me. Yeah. But it's a very vulnerable position. I mean, one bite to the organs can actually really hurt or kill that dog. Something that's very interesting about us as a human animal is, y'all can let me know if you recognize this or again, try it on yourself, but this part of appeasing, when we tilt our head to the side, we make ourselves smaller. What we're doing is the same thing the dogs do, is we're revealing our jugular vein. Is that deep? It's so deep. Same thing as the dogs. We just have our version because our organs are always showing, which is maybe why we have such a hard time. And we feel so vulnerable. But this is, I'm like, here's my jugular, don't hurt me. Yeah. We can also see in the animal world, the fight response. We do the same thing that mammals do, which is we puff up, right? We make ourselves bigger. We get a little taller. We puff up the chest. Sometimes we'll set the jaw. That fight response is automatic. That does not come from our neocortex. That comes from our nervous system and very old parts in our brains that go, boom, I'm going to get myself bigger. And therefore, maybe I can intimidate, right, the threat into not harming me. Yeah. I want to give one more animal example because it's my very favorite, which is, you know, we have the freeze response. And having worked with a lot of people who have been sexually assaulted and raped, often people who are being sexually abused freeze and go into a process of waiting until it's over, right? That is not a conscious decision. That is a very wise, very quick decision, right? To be able to survive what's happening. But often these people are so frustrated with themselves that they didn't fight back, right? And I really try to imbue, and this is what I love about somatics too, is the wisest thing, your body chose the wisest survival strategy for you. Even if you're mad at it today, even if you're so frustrated that you keep doing it when you mean not to, there is deep wisdom inside of that survival strategy. And then it generalizes, right? And it's that generalization that gives us the problem and what creates the habits and the soma that we need to unpack. But back to the animal that's such a great freezer is the possum, right? So you know how possums play dead, right? What's actually happening, which is just amazing, is that possums actually have a chemical change and they go into a coma. So they are literally in a coma state. Then they foam at the mouth and their eyes roll back. It's amazing. They literally, to a predator, look like, uh-oh, what's happening? This thing looks dead. They're not pretending, right? But the best part of a possum is the possum excretes a smell like it's been dead for 3 days. So I'm a coyote and I come up and I'm like, it's limp, it's foaming at the mouth and it stinks. If I eat this, I'm going to get sick. I'm going to go find my lunch someplace else, right? That is the actual wisdom of the freeze response. And I often thought we missed out on kind of an evolutionary strategy that we don't have that smell thing, that we could freeze and then like smell like we've been dead for 3 days. I think that would be more effective. Freezing. But anyway, it's just fascinating how again wise all these strategies are. Okay. So fawn, I don't know why we don't call it fawn, but I haven't ever called it that. I'm going to pivot a little bit, but any more questions, Leela, before then?
There's one question that I was going to put a pin in, but we can put a pin in it together. It is, does trauma impact the human body as manifested in cancer? How does somatic therapy help to treat cancer? So I don't know if that's something you want to address now or perhaps bring up later if it's something within your context.
I'll say something about it now. Trauma impacts many, many, many things about our physical health. And again, somatically, we would say that our mental, emotional, physical, and social health are interdependent and inseparable. Yeah. So that's just the baseline. So as we transform and get to heal trauma, right, holistically, not just understand it, like understand what happened to us and why it happened, but actually transform the survival strategies, the hypervigilance, distrust, right, a lot of the symptoms that we're left with after trauma, as we build new skills and competencies and abilities, right, more somatic choices, it will affect our physical health as well. I think cancer is a very, very complicated piece. So I'm not competent. I'm not going to say anything there. But there's so many multitude of factors, including environmental factors, that are really connected to cancer rates. You know, what it is connected to, if I think about climate justice work, if folks aren't familiar with that term, what environmental justice is or climate justice is it's looking at environmental sustainability, right? How do we come into right balance with the planet so we're not destroying our home? Connected with social justice issues. Yeah, so connected with the issues of equity for people. So climate justice is connecting those pieces. And sadly, of course, what we see is poorer communities tend to live closer to toxic dump sites. There is an increased amount of cancer, right, in what are called fence line communities. So cancer is complicated, and the more resilient, resourced, and healed we are somatically around trauma lets us be more physically resourced. That's as far as I will go with that answer, but thank you for asking. All right, I'm going to talk about what happens when we don't connect personal and systemic transformation, and then a little bit more about what's possible when we do. So in the West, I'll use that broadly, we have inherited a fairly individualistic worldview. Yeah. So kind of like, how am I doing? How do I heal? What is my dream? How do I succeed? Right? A fairly individualistic understanding of change, and also a fairly individualistic understanding of accomplishment, right? Like we earned it or we didn't earn it, right? And inside of that, of course, what kind of gets disappeared is our interdependence, and also how many kind of background props there are or privileges there are, depending on what community that you're from or that you live in. So one of the limitations of having an individualized understanding of transformation is that healers, practitioners, somaticists who really, really are committed to healing and transformation can inadvertently, it's not on purpose, but inadvertently set up the same systems of inequity that we literally don't value and don't believe in. And some of the ways that shows up is in places where there is a lot of racial or gender or sexual diversity, that we end up with rooms that are pretty predictably primarily white, primarily middle or upper class, and primarily straight. It can end up while so many people have contributed to somatics, it can end up a lot that the people who get credited for somatics are straight white men, right? From Western nations. Yeah. You know, I love all the emotional intelligence work. And as a feminist, I get so frustrated that it is a straight white man who gets credited for emotional intelligence work, because it has been the work of women and queer people forever, right? So inadvertently, we repeat these systems of domination and oppression when literally in trauma healing is exactly the impacts that we're trying to help people heal from or help ourselves heal from, right? So it's like we're all of a sudden at counter purpose. And so, you know, in the whole idea of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention, it's a public health model. that, you know, in some ways the images at the bottom, you know, the bottom of the river, people drag bodies out of the river and trying to revive them, right? Tertiary prevention. Secondary prevention is walking up river and trying to pull them out sooner. And primary prevention is going all the way up the river and going, who's throwing people in the river? Stop throwing people in the river, right? So if we really look at social change, it's the primary prevention to trauma. I know this is a big statement, but I swear at this point in, it is really what I believe and what I see, that if we work collectively for equity, racial equity, gender equity, a true radical democracy, right, a sharing of power where we are in balance with the earth, our trauma rates are going to drop 90%. Because we're not using violence to harm and to dominate, right? Which is what most of us are hurt from, yeah? So there will still be natural disasters, right? There will still be accidents. Those things are traumas that keep happening because we're just humans and shit happens. But the vast causes of trauma are dominance, social inequity, and the violence used to keep that intact. Yeah. So I'm public about this, but I was sexually abused as a kid. And that is obviously a very, very, very personal experience, right? And I feel so fortunate that after crawling for a while, I really found my way to healing and support and the level of transformation that I needed to really mend from those experiences. And when I back up and I look and I started to learn that, you know, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before their 18th birthday. When I backed up and I looked and 80% of women in prison were sexually abused as kids and 65% of men who are in prison were sexually abused as kids, right? When we start backing up and going, holy moly, these numbers equal it's a systemic issue, right? So we want to address it through individual healing, but we want to go to the root causes of the trauma, which again is really changing a social contract, right? That's based on power over to a social contract that's based in power with. All right. Oh, this is a fun conversation. I hope you guys are having a good time. All right, Lila, gonna come back over. Comments or questions?
I'm just so grateful for that entire segment. So meaningful, so powerful, so frustrating, so much healing work around that. And I think you put it so beautifully. And yeah, please go ahead. You can unmute yourself, please.
Can I jump in? I didn't want to cut you off.
Please.
Okay. So before I start with my question, Stacey, just thank you so much for your time and your work. It has changed my life and mm-hmm. how I approach my own coaching, and just the mainstream coaching business really lets me down, and have to have a body of people talk about the intersections between personal transformation and social justice transformation is so important. We need that. So my question, so I work with activists who are in the climate justice space, and right. one of the things that comes up a lot is burnout, of course, and emotional fatigue. And I'm curious what you would say about hope. I'm curious what you're hopeful about. Yeah.
You're going to give me the hardest question of the night. Okay.
One, I'm just so curious what you, as someone in this work since the 80s and 90s, really just diving in and seeing it transform to what it is today, especially with how many crises are hitting its head right now. What gives you hope? Like, what keeps you going?
Yeah, thank
what
you.
What can I take and bring that to my work?
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to talk about climate justice a little bit first, and then I will talk about hope. I also work with both in coaching and with teams in climate justice organizations. And what I have realized at this point is that people who are brave enough and willing enough to put themselves in the face of the climate catastrophe daily need regular spaces to grieve and need regular spaces to practice collective resilience. Or I think there's no way, there's just no, it's too hard on us. You know, like we're looking at, you know, at this point we're threatening all life, you know? I mean, I do think the earth will make it, even if humans are gone and we take out all large mammals, bacteria are gonna hang out and something's gonna happen. But I so don't wanna go that road. I would rather us change. But what we found, like there's this executive team I work with in a big climate justice organization. And we really found that 3 times a year, we have to purposely stop and do collective practice and process around grieving. It's almost like keeping their channels clear, keeping their somas unblocked, because at some point we numb and then we contract and then we start acting out on each other. It's just totally predictable, right? And the other thing is really sometimes having a place for anger, but then a very conscientious practice of resilience. And it's actually the practice I wanted to do on the call together today. So I'll maybe pivot soon to do that. As for my hope, God, you're asking me at a really intense time, but we're all living this intense time. Okay, if I be very honest with you, to me, I do not see somatic process and spiritual path as different. To me, they're very intersected for me. And really, I mostly right now try to listen very, very deeply to something very much larger and just kind of go, okay, what's right action? What's right action? In some ways, what's right relationship to what's happening right now? And that is the place from which I get hope, is really listening and trusting I'm alive at this moment in history, and let me be with community, with all the people that are voting for life, you know, that are taking action to serve all life, that gives me hope. And then really small things is like, I was walking by this redwood tree today and it had new growth on it. And I was like, look, oh, you know, like life keeps happening, life keeps lifing. So that's maybe the smaller things that give me hope.
I really love that. Life keeps lifing. And you're calling it a nice practice to just observe too, which I appreciate.
Thank you. You're welcome. Yeah, noticing. I'm going to say one more thing about why we really need to connect these things. How do I want to say this? When healing practices hit an economy that's based on the accumulation of wealth, then healing can get kind of contorted into wealth building. Now, I believe that all of us should have enough, right? Enough for our well-being, enough for our family, enough for good education, all of that. I have no argument. We all need that. And actually there is plenty already. There's plenty. But the focus of accumulation of wealth and status and who that accumulates in, I don't know if y'all know, but during COVID, there's 22 new billionaires in the United States, right? And then other people are starving and dying. It's just broken. It's broken. But we really have to watch this as somatics becomes more popular and somatics becomes more kind of nationally and internationally known, that we need to put very deep ethics right into the middle of it and really ask ourselves, somatics for the sake of what? What future am I trying to contribute to through doing a deep embodiment process or practice? And then we need to ask ourselves, like, embodied transformation for whom? For whom? Yeah. And then we all need to go, how much is enough? Not just for us individually, but also for the field, right? Who is the field serving? I do think we're in a moment of really shifting to a much more diverse body of people, both racially, gender and queer wise, influencing and helping to define the next generation of somatics. I think that's very, very important. But somatics for the sake of what and somatics for whom? To answer that question with a very deep ethic and to also help each other and help the field stay accountable to an ethic that is about individual and collective transformation. Yeah. Okay. Leela, do I have like 5 more minutes?
Or 2 more? You do. You have like 7 minutes and we have 2 questions.
Okay.
So
I do a practice. Yeah.
Great. Rind asks, what does the practice of collective grieving look like?
Oh, yes. Well, there are people who just specialize in collective grieving. So know that. But one of the really processes that we use, God, I'm gonna refer to things that will make no sense. Anyway, there's a collective process that we have of centering, which is basically just getting present, open, and connected with ourselves, with each other. And then there's really a process of going from a contracted state to an opening state, a contracted state to an opening state. So how we start a collective practice of grieving is, of course, we always inside of every practice set an intention, like what's the purpose of this? And then we do it from the body up. So we'll do a centering practice, we'll do a contracting and opening. And then inside of that, depending on what's happening with a group, we might include storytelling as a part of it, right? Somatics is body plus emotion plus language, right? We hold language, storytelling, right? What is therapeutic as a part of somatics? And then again, depending on the context and the culture shared by people, after storytelling, if it's again appropriate for the context that we're in, there can be a supported grieving, crying, or wailing process to really let the emotions of the grief come forward. Yeah, and in the context of that, of course, we're always paying attention to how do we soften the body? How do we let the emotion come through the body? Just talking about it is limited. Talking about it is part of it, but limited in what it lets the collective body process. Yeah. All right, I think I wanna go into this practice. Is that all right?
Sure. Okay. Yes. Okay.
So just because we're virtual, I want to lead us in a seated practice that is about accessing resilience. Okay. So embodied resilience, what we're going for. So I'm going to ask everyone to first let their attention just drop more into your felt senses. So you might notice the temperatures happening in your body, where you feel more warm or where you feel cooler. You might notice where there's movement in your body. It could be your breath, it could be your heartbeat. Maybe you have some twitching or streaming. Just notice any of that. And then as we're starting to drop our attention into ourselves, let your eyes relax, like they could soften back in the socket. And then let your jaws relax so your teeth aren't touching. Yeah. And if you can, take a couple of deep breaths kind of all the way down your spine. And then I'm going to invite all of us, I'll do it with you too, to recall a very specific or particular experience in which you felt resilience. And what I mean by resilience is that you feel a state of wholeness, or you feel really deeply connected, or you feel a quality of joy connected to safety. We all describe it differently, but it's very life-affirming. There's a lot of research on resilience now, but it might be an experience of nature or animals. It could be an experience of like music, dance, or art. could be an experience of being very connected to another, but have a specific experience. Like, I'm from the mountains of Colorado. There's this particular trail that I love so much that's spruce trees and aspen. And when the aspen change and they kind of drop onto the spruce, like I'm going back to a very specific walk in that forest. So find what that is for you. And take yourself back to that experience, like you're recalling it and you're feeling it. And just go, what were you seeing in that experience? What were you hearing? What were you smelling? Were you with yourself? Were you with other people or trees or animals? Like, who was with you? And then notice what, being back in that experience, what are you noticing in your body? How does that resilience register in your tissues, in your nervous system? What do you feel in your body when you put yourself back into an experience of resilience? Just feel that. Let yourself notice if there's anything else you can recall or feel about the experience that will let you access that resilience even more. Like, I just noticed, it's like, oh, right, I could feel the dirt underneath my hands. So if there's anything else that helps you access that resilience, go ahead and remember that, recall that. And then really let that experience of resilience, let it really inform your nervous system. Let yourself register it, like you're letting it in a little bit deeper. Let the resilience really come into your tissues. And if you can notice in your own body, if you can, let the resilience go all the way down into your lower body too, if it's not there already. And then lastly, what can you literally practice that resilience again? And of course, you can do it in meditation or somatic visualization like we're doing. But like for me, when can I get myself literally in the pine and aspen trees again, right? When can I feed some of my resilience again? So for you, whatever it was, if it was music or art or an animal, when's the next time you can consciously put yourself in that environment that helps to nourish your resilience? We like to say in our work, and especially with social justice leaders, that a 5-minute resilience practice every day, a 30-minute resilience practice every week, and a 2-hour resilience practice every month, that we just want to keep nourishing our somas, our nervous systems, through resilience to keep giving us the capacity to both heal and lead.
I want everybody to write that down. 5 minutes resilience practice every day, 1 hour every week, and 2 hour every month. Oh, 30 minutes every week.
And
you're making it easy on us.
Every month. I am, but if you do it, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah. It is amazing. Stacey, this has been absolutely wonderful. just brilliant. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody's questions. And I know that as people bubble up with their questions, I invite them to your website to learn more about what you do at both Strozzi Institute and generativesemantics.org. Awesome. So special. I have like 20 notes. I'm like, oh, I like to say something at the end about what was wonderful, but there was just too much wonderful for me to pick any of these things. So thank you. The conversation can continue at the coffee portal, the coffee break area on the portal, also in the Facebook group. Obviously, a talk like this, you want to listen to again and again. There's just so much wisdom here. It's free for 48 hours. It's also forwardable to your friends. We invite you, you know, there's so much in this conference that is amazing. And I'd like you to just know a couple of things about purchasing the upgrade. One is it doubles in price at the end of the conference. The other is that for those who are able to do it, it is what helps us be able to put this conference on for free worldwide. And that's pretty cool. Also, if you are a trauma-based professional, there are additional discounts for you. And so just write in and talk to someone and they will get you an even further discount. But the thing that I'm loving so much about it is that the channel managers have put learning lists together in each subcategory so that you can progress through the speakers in a logical cadence. So you're building foundational knowledge and then continuing on. They're doing it with notes also for each presentation and audio only files, so it's transportable. It's kind of amazing. The amount of effort that has gone into making this available. But the most amazing part is the presenters, and we ask each presenter the magic question at the end of each presentation. And Stacey, now I get to ask you, what is your top tip on how to be more embodied?
Feel yourself and others deeply, which just means feel your own sensations and extend your attention and energy and be deeply curious about another.
Beautiful, not surprising. Absolutely wonderful. This has been a joy. Thank you to everyone who came. Thank you to everyone who has watched the recording. And thank you mostly to Stacey Haynes and the organizers of the conference. We wish you a wonderful, grounded, resilient future.
Good night, everybody. Thank you all.